Welcome to the Tom Hartmann Radio Program. Greetings, my friends. Tom Hartmann here with you, broadcasting live, coast to coast, border to border. It is the theme for the day. We as Democrats, I mean, we apparently have a train wreck coming here in Washington, D.C., as indictments are going to be coming down. Everybody's holding their breath, bated breath, everybody concerned about what's going on, what might happen, what, you know, who's going to be indicted. Hal Franken, God bless him, talking about, well, you know, if Dick Cheney is indicted for treason, should he be executed? And, you know, things like that. Really, there's a larger issue here, and that's the issue of, it's not just us versus them. It's not just, you know, good people versus evil people. It's not just Republicans versus Democrats. There's the larger issue of, we're really all in this together. There's the us. Right, there's the us, the all of us, who we really, really need to be considering. You know, the all of us. How can I say this? Here, let me tell you a story. To kind of illustrate this, because I think that this is really an important one. A couple of years ago, this was maybe 5-6 years ago, I was invited along with about 20 other people to hang out for a week, to go over to India and hang out for a week with the Dalai Lama. It was the result of my having written a couple of books, and this was not something I solicited. I didn't say, hey, in fact, I didn't even know about it until they contacted me and said, would you consider being one of the people who are there? And they were bringing in people from different disciplines. Like they had, for example, Fred Allen Wolf, the physicist, and he was representing physics and science, and Amit Goswami, who also wrote some books about physics, you know, was there on that. And I was there representing education. And anyhow, we had, and the goal was, and this was called the Synthesis Dialogues. And you can find the transcripts, and they actually sell tapes of the things and all that. Out on the web, there's a link off the homepage at tomhartmann.com to the information on it. But the goal of this was to meet for the 20 of us, more or less, to spend 5 days with His Holiness the Dalai Lama and talk about how to create a world that works for all. And in the second day that we were there, we were all figuring out. We had been there, you know, over the weekend before we met the Dalai Lama, and in this little town of Dharamsala, which is the Indian word for refuge. It's literally a town that they kind of created out of a vacant village in order, as a place for the Tibetans who were fleeing the communist Chinese, to find refuge, a place where they could hide out, where they could hang out, where they could be safe, and, you know, where they could come to. And so one of the things that we discovered was that this town of 150,000 people, more or less, and McLeod Ganj, which was the next town, like 8 kilometers, 5 miles up the road, which is actually where the Dalai Lama's house was, these two towns between them, maybe 150,000 people, that everybody in these two towns, they were all Tibetans, and they all had these horrific stories to tell about getting out of Tibet, about, you know, because the Chinese had come in, the Chinese had murdered the communist Chinese, the good buddies of the Bush administration, the best friends of Walmart, the communist Chinese have murdered over 1 million Tibetans. If you have a photo of the Dalai Lama in your house, they will kill you. In fact, there was, at the time that I was there, there was a news report in the national press about a guy in Tibet who was arrested along with his entire family because he had a T-shirt on that the local Chinese thought was a picture of the Dalai Lama. It was actually a picture of John Lennon. But they thought, you know, they thought it was the Dalai Lama. So they arrest this guy. And this is a crime executable by death or punishable by execution. So, and most of these people, you talk to these people, and I got to know a few of them. You talk to these folks, and they tell a story about how, I mean, they had to cross the Himalayas to get to this part of India. We were up in the mountains as it was. I mean, we were, I don't know, 6,000-8,000 feet. But, I mean, you know, and they're climbing over glaciers and, you know, snow, and there's lions and tigers and bears and, I mean, or tigers and bears, whatever they were, and there were bandits along the way and robbers, and they get the Chinese army after you, and a lot, and frostbite and cold, and there's no food along the way, and most of the people that we talked with started out as a family or two families or three families fleeing Tibet. I mean, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20 people. And by the time they got to Dharamsala, it was 3 or 4 survivors. I mean, these are truly tragic stories. So we're all talking about this stuff. without the Dalai Lama around. And those of us who were kind of politically inclined said, you know, we really need to do something about this. I mean, here we are, you know, with the Dalai Lama. How can we help him out? How can we help the people of Tibet be free of this murderous dictatorship, you know, the People's Republic of China? And we had a day of debate just among us, mostly Westerners. There were a few people from Europe and a few people from India and Australian, but probably half anyway of the contingent were Americans. And we had this debate, and there were a couple of people in the group who were saying, you know, we shouldn't involve ourselves in politics. We came here to talk about, you know, kind of esoteric stuff. How do you make a world that works? How do you change philosophy? How do you change religion? How do you change educational systems? How do you change science? Those kinds of things. You know, we shouldn't be taking a political position. And then there were others of us who were saying, hey, you know, politics is what underpins everything. We should all be taking a political position. So anyway, we had this knockdown, drag-out debate that actually got very contentious at times. And finally, after the end of, you know, a day of this, we came around to this conclusion. In fact, David Corton, the guy who wrote When Corporations Rule the World, David, a brilliant guy and a good friend, you know, made the argument that this is a real issue. So anyhow, David was there. He was one of the folks that was with us. And so the Dalai Lama, you know, the next day we get together with the Dalai Lama, and one of our group, you know, our kind of elected representative, as it were, says, Your Holiness, we've all decided that we will back a boycott of Chinese goods until China frees Tibet, if that's something you'd want. And he kind of smiles and says, you know, that's very, very sweet of you. And I'm paraphrasing wildly from memory now. This is not a verbatim transcript, although, as I said, you can find the transcripts out there. But in any case, he smiled and he says, you know, thank you. That's very kind of you. And pointed out that Richard Gere and Steven Spielberg had been there a few weeks earlier and had said something similar to that, apparently. And he said, now, but here's the problem. He said, my understanding of how this works is that if we were to have an economic boycott, a very sudden screeching halt to China's economy, that there would be families in China who would be badly impacted by this, that there may even be people who would starve to death as a result of such a sudden change in the world economy. And one of the group of us who had been very active in the anti-apartheid movement in South Africa stood up and said, that's absolutely right, Your Holiness. In fact, when we did the boycott, the multi-year, I think it was a multi-decade boycott against South Africa in the United States and Western Europe, there were people who died in South Africa as a result of the loss of economic activity. He said, that's the price you pay for freedom. Sometimes people do have to die. And the Dalai Lama said at that point, he said, well, therein is the problem. He said, because if the action that we take in this room causes the death of even one child in China, that's too high a price to pay. And now the conversation continued from there, by the way, and a little later on, the plot thickened, you know, and that's probably another discussion for another time. But in that moment, I got it. That all my life, I mean, back in the anti-war movement when Louise and I were first dating and we were out in the streets being pepper gassed in the 60s, back in the, from my early years until that point, I had there this notion of there's them out there and there's us in here. And, you know, of course, you always want to think that you're on the us in here, we're on the right side of it all, right? And I got it. He had just come along with a whisk broom, and I'm standing in this circle in the sand, you know, where I've drawn a circle around me and said, you know, this is us in here and that's them out there. And he's just come along with the broom and he said, sorry, no circle. There's no us. There's no them. It's all us. It's just all us. And I think it's really important when we hear about and deal with, and these indictments, for example, and we can all be very, you know, I mean, how can you stop people from being gleeful about it? I talked to John Conyers about this morning. He was this is the process. I talked with one of the Gold Star Mothers for Peace and a friend of Cindy Sheehan's, and she says she'll be dancing in the streets if there's an indictment. Yes, and this is a tragedy for America. Because the reality is that Karl Rove and Dick Cheney and Scooter Libby and George Bush are part of us. And if they've committed crimes, if they've harmed democracy, then we need to clean that up. But it's not, you know, using the Karl Rove worldview of taking anything and using that to destroy your, quote, opponent, end quote, and making it into an us versus them world, as George Bush has so tried to do. And here I am, you know, pointing out that difference. That's not the healthiest way to do it. There are better ways. It's 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. 21 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you, speaking from behind the good old working-class stainless steel microphone here in the People's Republic of the United States, or in at least the democratic, constitutionally limited Democratic Republic of the United States. There, how's that for you? Yes, it's a democracy, and it's a republic. All of the above. So here we have now Scotty McClellan coming out and saying, essentially, these guys lied to me. I thought this was fascinating. You know, this and then John Roberts from CBS, not the head of the Supreme Court, but the reporter for CBS News, talking about Mr. X, who may be indicted. And, you know, all the speculation, is Mr. X actually Dick Cheney? Could it be that the vice president of the United States could be indicted? You got Al Franken going on TV going, well, you know, maybe they should, you know, they execute people for treason. I mean, you know, should it be hanging or firing squad? And I'm not sure that's not necessarily a quote from Al, but I mean, they, you know, that's the question. The insider stories flying all over the place about what's going on. If we hear anything, of course, we'll let you know immediately. And David keeping track of the chat room and keeping track of the news wires and things. And we've got a whole news department here that's actually following these things. But at the same time, the Bush administration in a PR blitz on this thing, trying to essentially say, well, you know, as Kay Bailey Hutchinson the other day, I hope that nobody says that this is just about perjury, right? I hope this nobody horrors that somebody would say, oh, this is just perjury. Right. Here she is.
I certainly hope that if there is going to be an indictment that says something happened, that it is an indictment on a crime and not some perjury technicality where they couldn't indict on the crime, and so they go to something just to show that their 2 years of investigation was not a waste of time and taxpayer dollars.
This is the same Kay Bailey Hutchinson, the same senator from Texas, who said when Bill Clinton was charged with perjury that perjury is the most serious of all crimes because our entire judicial system depends and rests on, you know, knowing that people are actually telling the truth. So, you know, now we may be confronted with, you know, Fredo from Godfather 2, you know, where he comes to Michael Corleone and he's well, here's the...
I was kept pretty much in the dark. I didn't know all that much.
Yeah, right.
I can handle things. I'm smart. Not like everybody says. Like dumb, I'm smart, and I want respect.
Yeah. somehow I just kind of see that conversation going on, you know, between Cheney and Bush. But speaking of perjury, I think it's really important that, you know, we remember where all this came from. You know how all this started.
We must also never forget the most vivid events of recent history. On September the 11th, 2001.
Yeah, there, George Bush starting out with that and then going to...
First, I'm asked why Iraq is different from other countries or regimes that also have terrible weapons. While there are many dangers in the world, the threat from Iraq stands alone, because it gathers the most serious dangers of our age in one place.
Yeah, well, turns out, speaking of perjury, that it wasn't true. By and large, he knew it wasn't true. The weapons inspectors were saying it wasn't true. Even now, you've got, I'm just amazed, the Republicans that I have seen on the talking head shows, like on Chris Matthews' show, who say, and people like Matthews don't challenge them, who say, well, the Democrats were in favor of this thing. Excuse me, in the House of Representatives, more Democrats voted against it than voted for the war resolution. The Democrats were not in favor of this war, number one. And number two, the rest of the world didn't think Saddam had weapons of mass destruction. The rest of the world was listening to Hans Blix, who was saying, no, he doesn't have weapons of mass destruction. And, you know, you can believe that if you want, but there were people who believed in witches once, too, you'll recall.
You know, in the Middle Ages, when people were convinced there were witches, and then they looked for them, they certainly found them.
Yeah, and you know, Blix saying, well, that's what Bush is doing, and in fact, that's what Bush was doing, you know, sure enough.
If we know Saddam Hussein has dangerous weapons today, and we do, does it make any sense for the world to wait to confront him as he grows even stronger and develops even more dangerous weapons?
Turns out it was a lie. He knew it was a lie. Hans Blix was saying it was a lie. The Mohammed al-Baradei was saying it's a lie. And then they try and slash Joe Wilson for saying it's a lie.
This is a massive stockpile of biological weapons and is capable of killing millions. We know that the regime has produced thousands of tons of chemical agents, including mustard gas, sarin nerve gas, VX nerve gas.
Well, yeah, I mean, that was back when your daddy sold that stuff to them, if that's what you're talking about, or when Don Rumsfeld was over there selling that stuff to them. But, you know, and then, you know, of course, the unmanned aerial vehicles, the Uday's play, you know, his toy airplane. It's.
We've also discovered through intelligence that Iraq has a growing fleet of manned and unmanned aerial vehicles.
Yeah, we'll come back to those after this break. 27 minutes past the hour. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points come from Madison and Jefferson, not some right-wing think tank.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Turn the world into one big Texas.
Yeah. That's what George would like to do. Turn the whole world into one great big Texas. Oh, my goodness. No, we can't let that happen. Welcome back, my friends. It's 34 minutes past the hour. 34 and a half. Some of the folks in our chat room, you can get there by going to TomHartman.com, by the way, offering some suggested possible headlines we may see today. Let's see. Reagan pardons Libby. This from Philippe 66. Reagan pardons. Here's another one. Bush named as unindicted co-conspirator. Mom and Dad go to Astros game. I assume that must be a reference to how when George Bush's younger sister died when he was 7 years old, his mother and father went golfing the next day. Here's one. Bush offers daughters to Fitzgerald to avoid indictment. Or Bush offers children to military and deal to avoid indictment. I don't know. We'll see. Anyhow, there is one person in the chat room, Blue suggested iCasualties, the letter I, casualties.org. And then there's, you know, a bunch of / stuff after that. But you can track it down just off the main website. If you want the names of particularly the recent casualties, there will be vigils held all over the United States tonight. And I encourage you to check them out. Visit the one closest to you. If you go to moveon.org, you can plug in your zip code, and they will and tell how many miles you're willing to travel, and they will tell you what gigs are happening near you. So this is all the same stuff. The 2,000 people having died in the war and the indictments. This is all the same stuff. This kind of all goes back to, like, you know, we had bombed Iraq's Air Force into smithereens. There was nothing left. Uday or Qusay, one of Saddam's sons had a model airplane, a balsa wood model airplane he played with. They had a satellite photo of this thing or something. I don't know. Maybe Ahmed Chalabi came up with it. But here's what George Bush told us.
We've also discovered through intelligence that Iraq has a growing fleet of manned and unmanned aerial vehicles.
model airplanes.
It could be used to disperse chemical or biological weapons across broad areas.
Like a football field, maybe.
We're concerned that Iraq is exploring ways of using these UAVs for missions targeting the United States.
See, this is, you know, Bush saying he's coming to get us. I mean, that's perjury, isn't it?
Iraq has attempted to purchase high-strength aluminum tubes and other equipment needed for gas centrifuges, which are used to enrich uranium for nuclear weapons.
No, it turns out we knew he was lying then when he said that.
If the Iraqi regime is able to produce, buy, or an amount of highly enriched uranium a little larger than a single softball, it could have a nuclear weapon in less than a year.
And, you know, he keeps on going, I mean, with these things. It just never stops.
We've experienced the horror of September the 11th.
Yeah, let's bring it back to that.
We have seen that those who hate America are willing to crash airplanes into buildings full of innocent people.
And that's why we should invade a country that represents no threat.
Our enemies would be no less willing. In fact, they would be eager to use biological or chemical or a nuclear weapon.
A nuclear weapon. They're going to come and get us with nukes? Is that what you're saying, George? That's why we should go to war?
Facing clear evidence of peril.
Clear evidence.
We cannot wait for the final proof.
Can't wait?
The smoking gun. It could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
So if indictments come down for perjury today, let's remember, you know, the real perjury. And let's remember that it's all of us. We're part of this, too. We have to be politically active. We have to get out there. We have to get at the forefront of this stuff. And it's not just the war. I mean, there's a lot of other stuff happening in the news. You've got, you know, this $35 billion budget reconciliation. They're fixing to vote on drilling in Anwar. It just goes on and on. Walmart, this document just got leaked to the New York Times, internal Walmart document, essentially suggesting that, you know, somebody who's worked here 7 years, they're drawing more benefits than somebody who's just worked here a year, but they're not any more productive. Gee, I wonder what kind of conclusion one could draw from that observation. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM, 1-866-440-TOM, T-H-O-M, and Scott in Portland, Oregon on the line. Hey, Scott, welcome to the program.
Well, you cover so much ground, I never know where to jump on. The story about the Dalai Lama, I've heard you say that before. It's a great story, and it goes to the heart for me of why. You know, when people say, what can we do about getting the upper hand on the Republicans and so on and so on? Well, we have to play their game. We have to lie and cheat and steal and do all that. And it just doesn't feel right. You know, it's just
not
what we should do. And, yeah, we can rejoice with these indictments, you know, let alone convictions. But there should be some solemnity with all this because it really is kind of a dark moment. But I think the best part about it is that the rest of the world can see that the system does work.
Yeah, at least to some extent. I mean, we'll see how well the system works. But yes, that America takes this seriously, that our judicial system has some integrity left in it, that the Bushies have not yet turned us into, you know, Mussolini's Italy or Franco's Spain or Pinochet's Argentina, that as some actually are talking about. I mean, there's all these caricatures of America out there. I think this will help our reputation tremendously if there are some serious indictments for these crimes.
Hopefully so. But if that being said, I would vote for staking them to an anthill with Helen Thomas standing over them cackling.
with a pot of honey in her hand, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Pour on at her discretion.
A little honey dipper. Yeah.
Let me touch
real quickly why I called on the last hour of your show here locally. You were mentioning the Anwar drilling.
Right.
That our well-groomed Senator Smith made.
The Republican, yeah.
Yes. Was it a quote of his? It's no longer a lightning rod?
Yeah, that's literally what he said. If you go to blueoregon.com, which is one of the best Oregon politics blogs, it's their top story.
Got it. Yeah, because I called his office, and the guy there knew nothing about it and just kept saying, he's never voted for it.
And there's a link right to the quote, right to the article in The Hill by Alexander Bolton. And it's not just Gordon Smith, Scott. This is the interesting thing. It's Rick Santorum convened this closed-door meeting yesterday in Washington, D.C., and said to a bunch of Republicans, he said, you know, our internal polling now, or our polling out in the country shows that when you ask people, are you more concerned about $3 or $4 a gallon gas than you are about caribou in Alaska? You know, a year ago when we said, are you worried about gas going from $1.18 to $1.50 or caribou? They said, we're worried about the caribou. But now when you say, are you worried about gas going from $3 to $4 a gallon, they're worried about the gas. Screw the caribou. And
sure.
So the Republicans have decided that they're going to actually come right out in front and say, we're in favor of drilling for ANWR because it's going to reduce gas prices. Now, the reality is it's going to be 10 years before any of that oil makes it to the United States. It, in total, even at the most optimistic estimates, it's 6 months worth of oil. And really, the bottom line of drilling ANWR isn't, has nothing to do with national security or U.S. oil production. It has to do with the fact that there's probably somewhere between $10 and $50 billion worth of profit to be made in pulling that oil out of the ground for the companies that are supporting these Republican senators. That's
absolutely
the bottom line.
Yeah. And I'm reminded, too, when they built the Alaska pipeline, they were dedicated. They said that was dedicated for domestic use only. And now a good portion of it goes to Japan, and I have a feeling that this ANWR oil will probably end up going to China anyway.
Oh, sure. We're exporting oil from up there simply because it's all about the oil companies making a profit. And, by the way, it's our oil.
That's true. That is one place on the planet that we can say it is our oil, right?
Yeah, no, I mean, you know, that's public land. It should be our oil. So,
yeah.
You know, what, we're gonna give a lease to an oil company. They get to have our oil and then sell it to us? I mean, come on. Give me a break. Anyhow, Scott, thanks a lot for the call.
Check out
blueoregon.com if you want to see the link on that thing. Good to hear from you. Carl in Chicago, Illinois. Hey, Carl, what's on your mind today?
Hey, Tom, I wanted to jump off topic back to yesterday's interview you did with Andrew Gumbel.
Yeah.
I was a bit taken aback when he pretty much said that he thought Al Gore should rot in political hell.
I know, I let that slide by.
I was surprised by that, yeah.
Yeah.
Because it was my understanding that at that stage of the election / recount, that if the initial recounts were optional, chosen by the campaign would have had to have paid for those. And so that's one reason, I think, and that's a comment/question, that I thought they would have to pay for those. So, yeah, I don't think you'd want to recount the entire state. And the second point being, you know, if you couldn't get back even with Bush with the three, you know, primarily Democratic counties, then what's the point of recounting the entire state?
The fact of the matter is, and this is what the New York Times and the Washington Post both pointed out, the New York Times probably the most poignantly in their stories a year and a half later, when they actually finally counted the vote and discovered that Al Gore had actually gotten more votes in Florida, even after Jeb Bush had knocked 90,000 African Americans off the voting rolls, that Al Gore still got more votes than George W. Bush the poignant point that the New York Times made was that if they had only counted those counties that Al Gore had originally asked to have counted, Gore still would have lost. And that was, of course, the headline in the New York Times. It, you know, is the 17th paragraph that they point out that, by the way, if you count every vote in the state, Gore won. But as to whether, you know, how he came to that strategy, frankly, I don't know. I don't recall the intricacies of it. But I was horrified when Andrew said that he thought Al Gore should rot in political hell. I think Al Gore would make a wonderful president of the United States. I just didn't want to get off topic on voting machines and go off on some other, you know, tangent with him at that point in time. It's we were going down a particular road and I wanted to keep going down it. So I just let the cheap shot fly by. Thanks for pointing it out, Carl.
Another question, comment that any of your other callers could follow up on. He said it was with the consortium review that Gore at best, you know, would have won by a slim margin of a couple hundred votes. No, it's my understanding that Gore's, you know, the intent gap was somewhere in the range of 40,000 to 50,000.
Well, yeah, it depends on, you know, on which number you're looking at and which count you're looking at. But when the New York Times, when that consortium did their count and they actually looked at, you know, regardless of whether you measure intent or not, it was a few hundred. I mean, of actual hard ballots where they could say, here's the paper, we can prove it. Those ballots, by the way, as I recall, they were trying to figure out where to shred them or what to do with them. Interesting to find out what happened to that. I remember I seen a news story about that sometime last year about, you know, they were trying to figure out where they were going to dispose of them. Carl, thanks for the call, and thanks for listening to us there in Chicago. It is 45 minutes past the hour of the Tom Hartman radio program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman program.
Well, I was in the car and I heard this guy. He sounded all shook up and he told me why. His voice was a shaking on the EIB. Sounded like an Oxycontin eater to me. It was a bug-eyed, tone-deaf, flying Oxycontin eater.
Right-wing syndicated, swinging liberal people
beater. Right-wing, strung-out, hypocrite, prescription cheater. Rush looks strange to me.
And welcome back, my friends. No, no, I'm not going to touch our 10-foot pole. Welcome back to our program. 9 minutes before the hour of the Tom Hartman program. 1-866-440-THOM, our telephone number. By the way, if you want to call Capitol Hill, if you want to call your member of Congress and let them know what you think about all this stuff, the telephone number for Capitol Hill, area code 202-202-225-3121. There's also a toll-free number, 888-1-888-355-3588. 355-3588, just as an FYI. Annie in Olympia, Washington. Welcome to the program, Annie.
Hi, Tom.
Hey.
I wanted to respond to this issue about, you know, sort of how we might be feeling in anticipation of indictments coming down and who might be involved. And my own feeling is that the real tragedy has been existing for some time, and I equate it to a malignancy in the country, a cancer, an out-of-control, very destructive, aggressive organism that has kind of infested the country. And I look at what's happening now just the way you would greet a surgeon going in to remove that malignancy. And so it's a time of great hope, and the tragedy, the horror, the incredible negative energy and impact on the world, that has been existing. That's not going to emerge with Mr. Fitzgerald's work.
No.
Mr. Fitzgerald is actually taking, hopefully, I mean, if things are coming as it appears, he's taking those first steps to really rid the United States, you know, bringing to a sharp focus a diagnosis, and then taking the first steps to rid the United States of this terrible malignant administration.
Yeah, and let us be clear, Annie, that it's not just the Bush administration. It's not just the Bush family. It's not just George
right.
Bush. And it's not just the Republicans.
No, it's a perspective. It's a belief. It's this, you know, sort of a narcissistic perspective, corporate-driven perspective, because that somehow endless acquisition and indulgence of those who are just smart enough to get there, really, you know, there's this...
Yeah, or well-born enough, to quote Thomas Jefferson.
There was a remark yesterday, I can't remember who made it, but Bush, and it was about Punch Sulzberger, they were born on third base, but somehow thought that they'd hit a triple to get there.
Yeah, it's the old Ann Richardson joke about George W. Bush.
Yeah.
Well said, Annie. Thank you very much for calling and sharing that with us. I don't disagree. And there's just this kind of bizarre, I mean, it's still going on the right. Neil Bortz, for example, nationally syndicated talk show host, on the 25th, it was talking Fulton Industrial Boulevard in Atlanta, a place where there's a lot of streetwalkers. And he's talking about an article in the paper about a woman who's been with a one-year-old child who has been displaced as a result of Hurricane Katrina and is living in a hotel room and is concerned that, you know, what happens when the government stops paying for the hotel room because her home in New Orleans has been destroyed. And so
I dare say she could walk out of that hotel and walk 100 yards in either direction on Fulton Industrial Boulevard here in Atlanta and have a job. If that's the only way she can take care of herself, it sure beats the hell out of sucking off the taxpayers.
So, you know, yeah, just go out and be a prostitute. That's what, you know, I mean, this is the conservative mentality in this country is becoming increasingly apparent. Americans are figuring out what these guys are all about. And as Annie said, it's something requiring surgery, I think. Adolfo in Jenison, Michigan. Hey, Adolfo.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm great. We've only got about a minute and a half. What's up?
I am calling for everybody that's listening to your show to call those toll-free switchboards at our Congress, 888-818-6641 and 888-355-3588, and call for the impeachment of Bush.
Yeah, well,
Congress is turning their heads the other way. and they're not going to file for articles of impeachment unless they get pressured by the people.
But I can tell you that as long as the Republicans control the House of Representatives, that's not going to happen. I'm all in favor of everybody calling their members of Congress and saying, you know, if articles of impeachment should be placed. I'm all in favor of that. But it's more important, Adolfo, that you and I show up sometime this week or next week or the week after at the local Democratic Party meeting, the local county meeting, and say, hey, I'm here to volunteer.
I'm totally active, and I have been the whole time.
I mean, because we must build this thing from the ground up. This is what the Republicans figured out so well. I mean, this is the whole strategy that they put into place in the 70s, and it brought fruit. It bore fruit in the 80s, and here it is. And as progressives, and not even as Democrats. See, I think, frankly, if you're inclined to be a Republican, you should be active in the Republican Party. We need good people in the Republican Party as well. We're stuck with this two-party system here. It was the best the founders could come up with. It was a damn good idea when they started. I mean, it was better than the alternatives. And we got this two-party system. Let's get back into politics. Let's get back into these two parties.
Most Republicans are basically good people. Their problem is that they're being misled by their churches. I mean, George Bush gave their churches $1 billion to bribe them.
Yeah, and
you know, he bypassed Congress with that executive order to give all the churches, you know, $1 billion with a B.
Yeah, in the year prior to the election. I agree with you, Adolfo. I agree with you. It's not just the churches. It's also things like Fox News. I mean, you've got this a huge right-wing talking machine out there that's also misleading people, shall we say. Very clearly in some cases, very subtly in some cases, and occasionally telling the truth as well. I mean, you tip your hat to them, I suppose. But anyhow, it's 57 minutes past the hour. The Tom Hartman Radio Program, the pill that will help you escape the matrix.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Covers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends, to the second hour of our program. It's the Tom Hartman Radio Program, where being progressive never felt so good. Tom Hartman here with you. U.S. News, Harvard, and BP. As in British Petroleum, ban reporters from the First Amendment room at the National Press Club. This is an amazing story. Russell Mokaber and Robert Weissman, who at various times have each been on this program, tell this story in their newsletter, the Corporate Crime Reporter. They go down to this gig, this event that's being held at the National Press Club, which they're members of. By the way, and that's no small thing, you know, to become a member of the National Press Club is both expensive and you have to go through a certain qualifying process. Anyhow, they show up at an event which is co-sponsored by the Center for Public Leadership at the John F. Kennedy School of Government at Harvard University. It's going to announce America's Best Leaders of 2005. They're giving awards to Roger Ailes of Fox News, Thomas Friedman of the New York Times, Condi Rice, and Colin Powell. Sort of all in the same club, in my opinion. But in any case, C-SPAN was there covering it. And so they go over to the First Amendment Lounge to attend the event, this Mokaber and Weissman from the Corporate Crime Reporter. And they're met at the door by a guy by the name of James Long, who organized the event for U.S. News and World Report. And he says, you can't come in. Words to that effect. And they say, why? And he says, well, on the notices, it says RSVP. You didn't RSVP. So Mokaber and Weissman, they say, well, we didn't see anything about an RSVP, but we'll RSVP now. And no, you won't, Long said. You're not allowed in. But we're members of the National Press Club. Well, one of the rules of the press club, it turns out, is whoever rents the rooms, they get to make the rules. So British Petroleum, U.S. News and World Report rent the room and Harvard University, they get to decide who attends. They decide to keep out the guys from Corporate Crime Reporter. Now, why? Why, of all the reporters on the entire planet, were these two guys not let in? Well, they say, this is from the Corporate Crime Reporter, it has to do with the last U.S. News and World Report event we attended at the press club earlier this month. And they talk about this gig that they went to, this thing that this event, it was called Corporate America and Congress. Has Sarbanes-Oxley restored investor confidence? Now, the Sarbanes-Oxley bill is the one that basically says that, you know, your corporation has to be run appropriately. No more Enrons. It's the no more Enron law. And, you know, a lot of us think, well, you know, it's a nice step in the right direction, but it's by and large a joke. In any case, in an article published a couple of weeks ago in the Corporate Crime Reporter, they pointed out that this event has Sarbanes-Oxley restored investor confidence, that it was paid for by Altria. Altria, I mean, this is the tobacco company, right? It used to be known as Philip Morris. A tobacco company paying for a conference on social responsibility, they asked. The panelists included Senator Chuck Hagel, the former president of the voting machine company, now the Republican senator from Nebraska. William J. McDonough, the chairman of the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, PCOAB. John Castellini, I believe it is, president of the Business Roundtable. And Alicia McCulth Ellsworth, managing director of the Council on Institutional Investors. And during the Q&A, they stood up and they said, this is Russell and Mokaber and Weissman. Russell Mokaber and Robert Weissman. Russell and Robert. They stood up. And they asked the question, quote, Senator Hagel has said transparency is critical. What's the deal exactly between U.S. News and World Report and Altria? What are the details of the sponsorship? Members of the social responsibility community refuse to invest in tobacco companies. Did you find it a little odd that a panel on corporate responsibility is being sponsored by a tobacco company? You know, asking a question like that, you know, it's sort of like those inappropriate bodily noises that people don't like to make in public. You know, obviously. And that's how it was treated. Nobody found it odd. They pointed out in that article that a group of public health advocates at the University of California, San Francisco had set up a website, AltriaMeansTobacco.com, that documents that, in fact, the company changed its name from Philip Morris to Altria to hide the taint of tobacco in an attempt to restore a corporate image brought low by decades of deception and death. That's the quote from the website. They also said, quoting now from the article in the Corporate Crime Reporter, not too long ago, it would have been considered improper for a major news organization to team up with a major tobacco company to sponsor a forum on corporate social responsibility. After all, tobacco companies are in the business of killing off their customers. End quote. And in fact, they're right. Tobacco is the only product legally sold in the United States that causes death when used as recommended. Well, Mort Zuckerman of U.S. News and World Report and the so-called leaders at U.S. News and World Report, they didn't seem to be very pleased with this. So they didn't let Mokaber and Weissman into the First Amendment room for this First Amendment, you know, congratulations to the celebration of Rice, Powell, Friedman, and Ailes. As they say, a foursome who helped lead the country into a disastrous war of aggression. Defined by former Supreme Court Justice and Nuremberg prosecutor Robert Jackson as the supreme international crime, a war of aggression that has cost over 2,000 young American lives and untold thousands of Iraqi civilian lives. They asked the question, how can you celebrate a list of leaders, Rice, Powell, Friedman, and Ailes, who helped bring us this? And they ask, how can U.S. News and Harvard, BP, we can understand, the petroleum company, but how can U.S. News and World Report and Harvard University be complicit in barring reporters from an open press event from the First Amendment room at the National Press Club just because those reporters might ask embarrassing questions? Interesting. Or is that an embarrassing question itself? Mokaber and Weissman point out, they wrap this story up. It's just, and say it so well. And their website, by the way, I'm pretty sure is corporatecrimereporter.com, although I'll have, David will double check on that as we're going along. I don't have their website right here in front of me, but we'll get it to you shortly. In any case, they wrap this thing up and say, it is this kind of arrogance that has led the American people to turn on their leaders. According to a poll released today by U.S. News, 64% of Americans believe leaders today are corrupted by power, and 62% believe they're primarily looking for monetary enrichment, including those that were celebrated in the First Amendment room. So, it's an interesting point. Mokhber and Weissman coming out and saying, you know, at what point is the intersection between big corporate money and big corporate media destructive? I mean, this is now my language, not theirs. At what point is that intersection destructive to American democracy? Where is it? When does it begin to actually break down American democracy? When our news media and, for example, big tobacco companies or big oil companies are in bed together. And yes, by the way, the website is corporatecrimereporter.com. Just as an FYI. In fact, if you go to that, you'll find the story I was just sharing with you right there at the top. So, in any case, this is, I think, a really legitimate issue. And it gets back to the point of big corporations and big power. In the Financial Times of London on Friday, there was an article that came out of Brussels. Tobias Buck and Russell's wrote this thing. The European Commission. Now, this is what they're doing in Europe. It's the horror show continues. The European Commission is preparing a sweeping overhaul the way it prosecutes big companies such as Microsoft and Coca-Cola for abusing their dominant marketing positions, according to officials and documents seen by the Financial Times. You think, oh, great, they're going to make it harder for these companies to wipe out small competitors. No, the next paragraph. The new regime is likely to make it more difficult for the Commission to find large companies guilty of breaking antitrust rules. What? This is incredible. I mean, they go on to say, one of the most important innovations is that companies accused of an abuse would be able to escape punishment if they could demonstrate that their conduct had benefited consumers by producing efficiencies, for example, improved product quality or lowering prices. In other words, if a company gets bigger and bigger and bigger and defies antitrust laws, wipes out all the competition, wipes out all the small mom-and-pop businesses, and in the process turns out either a better product or lower prices, then you can't prosecute them for putting everybody else out of business in the European Union. We're already not prosecuting them in the United States for this, even though it's against the law. I mean, even it's against the Sherman Antitrust Act. It's still on the books. But no, we haven't prosecuted a company for that since Reagan came to power. 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Our program brought to you today by Small Dog Electronics, 1-800-511-MACS, 1-800-511-MAX, or smalldog.com. Get the latest iPods, all things Macintosh, all things computer. It's the radio program, the Tom Hartman program, where we dare to ask the question, is Walmart a person? And we dare to answer, no, just don't think so. Don't quite think so. Anyhow, this is the big companies in the European Union are getting an antitrust treat. And I got to finish telling you about that, and I've got an amazing Berlusconi alert coming up for you that answers all kinds of incredible questions about why Stephen Hadley, why Niger, why Joe Wilson, and what does Silvio Berlusconi have to do with it? We'll get to that in just a few minutes. But first, Ellen Ratner's with us with the Talk Radio News Service in Washington, D.C., talkradionews.com. Hey, Ellen.
Well, hi. And, of course, now we're hearing that there will not be indictments today, and we're also hearing that there is a good possibility that Fitzgerald could ask to extend the grand jury. And that has been done. It can be done. Would need a federal judge to to do that, but that is doable.
That's fascinating. Now, what, you know, does this mean that he's digging deeper, or, you know, is this a good thing?
Well,
or
it may mean that he's digging deeper. Of course, we now know that, depending on who you read, if you read the Washington Post, it's the FBI agents, if you read some of the online thing, it was the CIA, went to the neighbors of Valerie Plame to ask them when they knew, what they knew.
Right.
So that may be a whole other aspect of the investigation. And
in other words, looking at the original law that was alleged to have been broken by
exactly.
Bob
and
Novak.
Of course, the Republicans are saying it may just be a technicality if people are accused of perjury. Well,
yeah, of course. Kay Bailey Hutchinson is coming out and saying this. But if Fitzgerald extends the grand jury, is the consensus broadly in Washington, D.C. there, is the kind of talk behind the closed doors that you're so privy to and why I'm so grateful that you come on this program and share these things with us, is it that he may have an even stronger case and even bigger fish to fry and he needs a little more time to do it, or is it that his case is a lot weaker than he would like to have?
Nobody believes that the case is weaker. It may be that he is casting a wider net or a different net even. That nobody believes that he doesn't have the goods. I mean,
so this isn't seen as a sign of weakness. This isn't seen as a sign of weakness that he's saying,
no.
Let's stretch this thing out.
But he's a very careful prosecutor who is often known to bring things in two stages.
Interesting. So nothing today. So now also Cindy Sheehan today says we've passed the 2,000 mark in terms of the number of people, you know, American soldiers dead in Iraq. Her son was in the 600s, as I recall. Her son Casey, who was killed actually by Sadr's men, Sadr, who is now part of the government, or you know, one of the forces in the government or in Iraq. And she says she's going to tie herself or chain herself to the fence there. And there's others, David Swanson and others, who are going to be there with her. What's the story with that?
Well, I mean, that has happened in war protests for a long, or anti-war protests and other protests for a very long period of time. They'll get arrested, they'll go to jail, they'll get out. This is, you know, it'll give us certainly a relief from the George Bush show inside the White House, and, you know, make a lot of press. But, so we look forward to it. But I don't know any more than that's really what's planning.
But Cindy, I talked with Cindy yesterday or day before yesterday, and she said that she's just going to keep going back day after day. If they arrest her, she'll just go back. Every day she'll go back. I mean, what?
Well, at some point, if she goes back and keeps chaining herself to the White House, that, frankly, if I were her, I would not advise her to do that strategy because she's going to wind up like Kevorkian, where they're just going to stick her with a 6-month to a year jail sentence if she chains herself to the White House fence day after day after day after day, and they will shut her voice up. So my advice to her, knowing how Washington works and how the federal courts here, is that I would not choose that as a strategy.
Right, because then she would have no access to the media, and she would get forgotten.
Exactly.
I mean, it's amazing how quickly we forget.
She will get, you know, the way he's tried to pack the district court here, that is what will happen.
Yeah, okay.
So if you could talk to her, tell her, not a wise move. Also, a very interesting thing is, you know, the Democrats are salivating, feeling like this problem with George Bush may, in fact, really allow them to win the 2006 elections.
Mm-hmm.
And they released a report today, which included Albright, Sandy Berger, we know him, Leon Firth, John Podesta, called Combating Catastrophic Terror, and they are seeing several senators, Democratic senators, on the Hill, and what they want to do is to have the Democrats look very strong on security and use this as their platform in the 2006 elections. They're not saying that's what they're going to use it for, but clearly that is what it's designed to do.
Right, but what does strong on security mean? I mean, in my mind, strong on security means get us out of Iraq right now and let's, you know, rebuild the infrastructure of our army. Somebody else may say strong on security means we got to fight on for another 2 years.
Well, I don't think they're saying that this is – they're dealing much more with issues of sort of homeland security, what we can do in terms of border, what we can do in terms of containers, that kind of thing.
I see.
I don't think – I have not seen the report because it's just being released as we speak.
Yeah.
But I do know that it is – my guess is that it has not a whole lot to do with Iraq and more to do with where there really are gaping holes.
Yeah.
In our security.
Yeah, like there's still not screening cargo that goes on the airplanes that's sitting 3 feet below the people who got wounded.
And our military correspondence, a pilot, doesn't make us very comfortable.
There you go. Ellen Ratner, TalkRadioNews.com. Thanks, Ellen, so much for being with us. 27 minutes past the hour.
Bringing democracy to the United States of America, here's Tom Hartman.
I've been meek and hard like an oak. I've seen pretty people disappear like smoke. Friends will arrive, friends will disappear. If you want me, honey, baby, I'll be here.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Your light at the end of the tunnel of talk radio, defending America from the conservative weapons of mass deception. 3 hours a day, 5 days a week, right here. The European Commission. I was telling you about the European Commission and how the European Commission is sort of like, you know, to the extent that the various European countries have formed a confederation, something that sort of resembles a federal republic, you know, an organization of states. The European Commission is their equivalent of our federal government, as it were. It's a very imperfect analogy, but it's about as close as I can get. And the European Commission is now proposing laws, a sweeping overhaul, to quote the Financial Times, in how big corporations can be prosecuted for breaking antitrust rules, basically making it almost impossible to prosecute these big corporations. This is Article 82, Section 2, Article 82 of the European Commission's rules is essentially the same thing as Article 2 of the U.S. Sherman Act, the Sherman Antitrust Act. And notes the Financial Times, it's been a launchpad for some of the regulators' most high-profile and controversial cases, probes against Microsoft, Coca-Cola, Michelin, IBM, AstraZeneca. You'll recall, Microsoft, Bill Gates had to pay hundreds of millions of dollars, 497 million euros, that's 595 million U.S. dollars. Last year, as a result of a fine from the European Commission for trust violations, for antitrust violations. In other words, for being so big and using that bigness in a way that prevented smaller companies from even participating in the marketplace, that it was anti-competitive, that it was destructive to a so-called free market, any kind of a marketplace. So Microsoft is getting their revenge. And not just Microsoft, of course. I mean, all these big companies, Coca-Cola, Michelin, it's not any one particular company. It's that these rules are now going to be changed, apparently. And probably by the end of this year. So what we're seeing, in my opinion, and this is, frankly, this is going to be the issue of the, certainly of the decade, is whether we continue down the road that Benito Mussolini first set out of corporate power merging with state power to form a new corporate state alliance. And, of course, Mussolini thought he'd just do it in Italy. Right? Dissolve parliament, replace it with the chamber of fascist corporations. Franco thought he'd just do it in Spain. You know, Hitler did a little bit of it in Germany, but mostly it was Franco and Mussolini. Mussolini just thought he'd do it in Italy. Now we're looking at, could it be done worldwide? You know, the conservatives used to fear the communists. I think if they want to worry about the loss of U.S. sovereignty, they need to be looking somewhere else. So they need to be looking at these kinds of issues. In fact, it gets even stranger. Speaking of Italy, and speaking of, Our old friend Mr. Mussolini, who brought us the idea of the merger of the corporation and the state together in what he called the fascist state, or corporatism, as he referred to it. Time now for our Berlusconi alert for the day. Thanks to Shelby, by the way, from RadioPower.org for passing this along. This from the American Prospect, of all places. TruthOut.org published it. Laura Rosen, Italy's intelligence chief met with Deputy National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley just a month before the Niger forgeries first surfaced. Here's the kind of short form of this story. these crude forgeries. I mean, these forgeries that Bush was referring to in his State of the Union address when he said British intelligence has learned that Saddam Hussein is trying to buy yellow cake, he's trying to buy uranium in Niger. Well, this is all based on this forgery. And it looks like the source of the forgery may be associated with, according to investigative reporters Carlo Bonini and Giuseppe D'Avanzio, in a report by Niccolo Polari, according to these investigative reporters, it may be that the source of this has something to do with Niccolo Polari. He's the chief of Italy's military intelligence service, known as CIMSI. Now, get this. He had apparently tried to peddle this forgery to the CIA in 2002 and 2001. All the way back October 15th, 2001. He gave CIMSI. This is Berlusconi's head of intelligence. Is trying to peddle this forgery, and the CIA is not buying it. And so, what does he do? Well, today's exclusive report in La Repubblica reveals that Polari met secretly in Washington on September 9, 2002, with then-Deputy National Security Advisor Stephen Hadley. This was a critical moment, as the article notes. This is when Bush was trying to convince America to go to war against Iraq. Now, here you go. The CIA won't take it, but September 9, 2002, Berlusconi sends Polari to meet with Stephen Hadley. Our Berlusconi moment. Yes, indeed. Now, oddly enough, the paper... This was on September 9, 2002, that General Niccolo Polari met Stephen Hadley. The paper goes on to note the significance of that day, highlighting the appearance of a little-noticed story in Panorama, published 3 days after Hadley's meeting with Berlusconi's guy, Niccolo Polari. Now, you say, okay, what's Panorama? And what's the story that was in Panorama? Well, first of all, the story, which was published on September 12, 2002, claimed that Iraq's intelligence agency, the Mukhabarat, had acquired 500 tons of uranium from Nigeria through a Jordanian intermediary. So here's the story, right? It's in this Italian newspaper, it's in this Italian magazine, 3 days after Hadley meets with the head of Italy's intelligence service. Now, who owns the magazine? this is the incredible thing. It was Silvio Berlusconi who owns the magazine. Berlusconi, the guy, the small-time businessman and crook who buys a newspaper, buys a radio station, buys a TV station, buys another TV station, buys another radio station, buys a radio network, buys a TV network, buys another radio network, buys another TV network, buys a couple more magazines, buys the biggest newspaper. Pretty soon he ends up owning virtually all the media in Italy and then runs for prime minister. And, surprise, surprise, wins. And his own one of the many magazines that he owns, this magazine, a weekly magazine called Panorama, publishing this story saying that Saddam is buying uranium from Nigeria. Very interesting. And so what may be of most significance to American observers, however, notes this article in the American Prospect, is the newspaper's allegation that the Italians sent the bogus intelligence about Niger and Iraq not only through the traditional allied channels such as the CIA, who, by the way, had apparently rejected them for 2 years, but seemingly directly into the White House. Directly into the White House. Following the exposure of the discredited Niger allegations in the summer of 2003 by Joe Wilson, White House officials first sought to blame the CIA for the inclusion of the controversial 16 words. Remember that? Condi Rice and Stephen Hadley accepted some responsibility. But then the White House goes hysterical on Joe Wilson because he points out that it was all a lie. So, the American Prospect, this article by Laura Rosen, notes Hadley's meeting with Polari keep in mind, Hadley was Rice's number two person, Condi Rice's number two person, meeting with Polari, who's Berlusconi's head of intelligence, at precisely the time when the Niger forgeries came into the possession of the U.S. government, may explain the seemingly hysterical White House overreaction to Wilson's article almost a year later. Which, by the way, is what the grand jury's looking into. It's all coming around. This is incredible. And why did Berlusconi do this? According to La Repubblica, for Berlusconi and Polari, the overriding motive was a desire to win more appreciation and prestige from the Americans who were seen as eager for help in making their sales pitch for war. In other words, George W. Bush is trying to pitch a war in Iraq. The Americans aren't buying it. All over the world, people are marching and saying, no, we don't want no stinking war with Iraq. This guy's no threat. You've bombed his Air Force into smithereens. No fly zone. You've starved his country for 8 years. I mean, no war. And Berlusconi says, my friend George needs some help. And apparently, his intelligence service cooks up this lousy forgery saying that Saddam is trying to buy uranium from Nigeria. And his head of intelligence, General Niccolo Polari, flies to Washington, D.C. on September 9, 2002 and meets directly with Stephen Hadley, Condi Rice's number two person. And all of a sudden, George W. Bush and Berlusconi's magazine are talking about how, that's Saddam, he's buying uranium from Nigeria. We got to stop him. The guy's trying to build a nuclear bomb, can't you tell? I mean, that's what it's all going to come to. It's all going to be nuclear bombs as far as the eye can see. We got to do something now.
We cannot wait for the final proof, the smoking gun that could come in the form of a mushroom cloud.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Good morning, Mr. PC. I trust you're doing fine. Your eyes are shining clearly, and your feet are keeping time.
And welcome back, my friends. 50 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. And 9.5 minutes before the hour. You can put it either way. Is that a glass half empty, glass half full kind of? No, the clock. Which way do you look at the clock? Upside down or anyhow, welcome back to our program. Just a reminder, all across the United States today, their anti-war groups are going to be holding vigils, in some cases reading the names of the dead or of the recent dead in Iraq to commemorate the passing of this horrible milestone of 2,000 dead in Iraq. And you can find out where a vigil will be near you by going to moveon.org and plugging in your zip code. And that'll get it to you. Some of the proposed headlines for tomorrow's newspapers that we're finding. some of these are absolutely great. I think most of these came from, where to go? Well, I'll tell you as I go along. Anyway, from Philippe 66. Here we go. Guckert accepts service for Rove. Oh yeah, okay. So they show up at the White House to serve Karl Rove and Jeff Gannon is there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Bush served while riding bike. Well, that makes a certain amount of sense. Bush sends Blackwater stormtroopers to arrest Fitzgerald. That's within the realm of possibility. Cheney tortures Fitzgerald to find out, quote, what the bastard knows, end quote. Bush wants to know if Fitzgerald is, quote, available. Not sure what that means. Bush Sr. says Rumsfeld should nuke Chicago. Bush wants to know if Fitzgerald... Yeah, we already did that. Cheney tortures, yeah. Okay. So, Tim Russert's suit checked for stains. Well, that's a little... the folks in the chat room are getting a little strange here, but it's... The glass is twice as large as it needs to be, says 2KY. Okay, I'll go for that. Indeed. Anyhow, you can get to our chat room by going to tomhartman.com if you want to drop in and say hi, by the way. So just one more time, a quick reminder. Check out moveon.org. Plug in your zip code. You can find out where the vigils are tonight. We need, folks need to be showing up and speaking out. Our telephone number, 1-866-472-5787. 1-866-440-THOM, 1-866-440-TOM. Rick in Grand Rapids, Michigan on the line. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Well, I wanted to discuss the CIA leak case, and I saw Gordon Liddy on Fox News, I believe it was Monday evening, and, you know, he's a former prosecutor as well as an ex-con, and he said that perjury is only perjury if it, and I don't know if you use this word, if it deals with germane issues. He says, for instance, if he were accused of robbing the bank, and he was asked by a prosecutor or whatever if he had spent the night with Barney Frank, which I thought was kind of a strange thing to talk about, and I guess Barney Frank was kind of offended by that. He says it wouldn't matter. Now, I guess he forgot that this original Whitewater investigation of Bill Clinton was about a land deal, and somehow that got conflated with Paula Jones' lawsuit, and Ken Starr got involved with that. And, of course, I'm not a lawyer, but I do know that when you have a situation where you're investigating a land deal and it somehow gets involved with sexual harassment, and then you nail Clinton for supposedly lying about Monica Lewinsky, which
wasn't a sexual harassment case.
No,
by the way. In fact, it wasn't even a crime. It's not against the law for two adults to have sexual relations.
Well, I guess technically fornication is against the law, but we'd have a lot of people in jail if they ever, you know.
Well, it depends on the state.
Right.
There are some states where it is. I don't know what the law is in Washington D.C.
Okay,
frankly.
But the point is that Paula Jones, I think people forgot, was not actually talking about a sexual attack of any sort because the statute of limitations has passed. What she actually was saying was she didn't get flowers on Sweetest Day or something like that, or Boss's Day or what have you. So anyway, all of that led to an impeachment of the president. I fail to see how lying about this situation, which involves outing a CIA agent, I don't know how that couldn't be relevant, no matter how you twist it. I'm hearing people, even people like Chris Matthews, who seems to be pretty much anti-Bush right now, saying, well, we don't know if this is a crime, and you can't out a CIA agent and have it be a crime unless you know you're doing it. Well, why would you do it unless you knew you were doing it?
Well, he means unless you know that you're committing a crime. But the point is well taken, Rick, and there's this larger issue, and that is, and this is what we need to keep bringing people back to. And I know Katrina Vandenhoevel did that on Chris's show a couple days ago, but the point that we need to keep coming back to is this was all about a campaign to lie us into a war.
Yes.
This is all about an illegal war. This was all about an absolutely plain old, flat out illegal war. And Bush lied about the war. I mean, you know, it's
right. And I think, you know, I think you mentioned Al Franken kind of joking about the capital offense here. You know, Al a lot of times says things that are funny that are actually true. I believe if you could actually prove that Bush and Cheney had something to do with outing a CIA agent and lying us into a war where 2,000 people have been killed, I don't think capital punishment is out of the question. I really
don't. Okay, I'm not going to go there, Rick.
Well, you don't have to, but I'm just saying. You know, I know it would be a terrible thing to say that of any president.
I do think, though, that rises to the level of high crimes and misdemeanors, which is what the Constitution defines as an impeachable offense. It may or may not be treason, but it certainly is high crimes and misdemeanors. The treason part, the part that I find interesting, is that they had brought Ahmed Chalabi into this whole thing, and he was working for Iran, as far as we can tell. If you want to get into, you know, Benedict Arnold's stuff, I mean, questions about how you define treason. We should get John Dean back on the program. He wrote a book called Worse Than Watergate about this stuff, and I think it's still absolutely and totally germane to this day.
Watergate was nothing compared to all this.
No, I agree. Rick, thanks a lot for the call. Good to
Thank
hear
you.
From you. I appreciate it. Yeah, and George Bush, you know, talking about the inspectors, very strange.
And the fundamental question is, does Saddam Hussein have a weapons program? And the answer is absolutely. And we gave him a chance to allow the inspectors in, and he wouldn't let them in.
Now, you hear that? Bush saying Saddam wouldn't let him in? I'm sorry. Yeah, I see. Saddam was asking them in. Saddam was saying, keep them here. Don't bomb us. Keep the inspectors here. Bush pulled them out so that he could begin his bombing before the UN authorized it. That's what happened, my friends.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And the conservatives seem to be imploding, or at least the neoconservatives, the old-fashioned conservatives are standing up saying, hey, wait a minute, wait a minute. Last week's Newsweek, George Will, the last word, the last page article, he says, agriculture subsidies increased 40% while farm income was doubling. Say, hey, hang on just a second, let me get this right. You're going to increase welfare to the big agriculture industry while they're making more profit? Yeah. Yeah. Agriculture subsidies increased 40% while farm income was doubling, says George Will. Conservatives, see, this is the old-fashioned conservatives. Conservatives concerned about promiscuous uses of government were appalled when congressional Republicans waded into the Terry Schiavo tragedy, says George Will. He talks about the transportation bill's cost. He says the transportation bill's cost, honestly calculated, exceeded the threshold that the president had said would trigger his first veto. The George W. Bush has never vetoed anything. He never saw a spending bill he didn't like. He liked every single one of them. Yeah, just fine. All these bills. He never saw a spending bill he didn't like. So, as George Will says, honestly calculated, exceeded the threshold the president said would. He also points out that George W. Bush is the first president in 176 years to serve a full term without vetoing anything. Bush Sr., 44 vetoes. Ronald Reagan, in 8 years, 78 vetoes. In 87, Reagan vetoed a transportation bill because it contained 152 earmarks, otherwise known as pork, $1.4 billion. See, we're seeing the imploding of the neocons. We're just seeing the meltdown here. And the old-fashioned conservatives are saying, you know, the people who actually, to some extent, toe the line, that the only president in the last 30 years to have followed was Bill Clinton, ironically enough, that you should have a balanced budget. The old-fashioned conservatives are starting to flip out. George Will here again in Newsweek. He says, the bill President Bush signed contains 6,371 earmarks costing $24 billion. Total cost of the bill, $286 billion, is more in inflation-adjusted dollars than the cost of the Marshall Plan, you'll recall rebuilding Europe, the interstate highway system, you'll recall every highway in the United States, the Eisenhower interstate highway system, combined. If you combine both of them, the Marshall Plan to rebuild Europe and the entire interstate highway system, the expense of all of those adjusted for inflation. So we're talking, you know, dollars to dollars, apples to apples. The transportation bill that George Bush just signed with 6,371 pieces of pork in it was greater than the Marshall Plan and the interstate highway system combined. And this has got the old-fashioned conservatives, folks like George Will, going, whoa, whoa. He also points out, since 2000, the number of registered lobbyists in Washington has more than doubled from 16,342 to 34,785. He says they're not there to limit government. He says conservatives are not supposed to be cuddly or even particularly nice. They are, however, supposed to be competent. Well, yeah. I don't know. I think Everett Dirksen was the last competent conservative. And probably most of the people listening to, most of you are not old enough to remember who Everett Dirksen was. But in my opinion, he was the last competent conservative. We haven't had one since then. And so what we're seeing instead is the people who have stolen the word conservative and used it to massively expand government and use that expanded government as a honeypot, as a way of accumulating the tax dollars from you and me, by the way, while they're giving back more and more of our money and, in fact, borrowing money from our children and grandchildren and giving it to their wealthy buddies and themselves, multimillionaires like Dick Cheney and George W. Bush. Growing government like crazy on the back of debt that our children and grandchildren will have to pay, And I realize I'm sounding like an old-fashioned conservative. I'm sorry. This is not conservative or liberal. This is American. Franklin Roosevelt didn't like the fact that to get us out of the Great Depression, he had to borrow money in order to fund the WPA, that he had to do deficit spending. He came out and said it. He didn't like it. But he had the Great Depression to deal with. George W. Bush, he's got nothing like that to deal with. What he wants is political capital. This is all about politics. It's all about buying friends. Why would you give $1 billion to churches in a year when Congress won't even go along with it? So you do it by executive order, as Rick, our caller in the last hour, pointed out. Why else? To buy votes? So the neocons are melting down, and they're melting down fast, and it's starting to look like, and there's a kind of a growing opinion about this, that maybe Patrick Fitzgerald has now flipped Scooter Libby. Scooter Libby, looking at years in prison, may have become a witness for the prosecution. If that's the case, the only person that he could be prosecuting is Dick Cheney. Well, it's conceivable it would be George W. Bush as well, but in all probability it would be Dick Cheney. Now, why is it that people are speculating about this? Because all of a sudden, Scooter Libby discovers notes that he had about a conversation with Dick Cheney back in 2003. June 12th of 2003, to be specific. And just by coincidence, those notes of that conversation from June 12th, 2003, happen to be the conversation, according to the notes that Scooter Libby has just discovered, in which Dick Cheney told him that Joe Wilson's wife, Valerie Plame, worked for the CIA. You know, he'd been saying up to that point, before that, he'd been telling the grand jury he learned this from journalists. That was the line. Remember, Rove and Scooter Libby, they were both saying, I heard it from a reporter. And the reporters are going, no, I heard it from him. I heard it from Libby. And so now Fitzgerald goes back and says, okay, Libby, Scooter Libby, assistant to Vice President Dick Cheney, lead cheerleader for the war in Iraq, for invading a country that represented no threat to the United States whatsoever, but had a heck of a lot of something we wanted. I mean, what could it have been?
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Well, it could have been that. It could have been, you know, that. Could it have, you know, been that Cheney's an oil guy, and the oil guys, they want that oil because they can make a little more money with the oil. You know, it's, could be. It appears, you know, that John Hanna, who was Cheney's national security advisor, has flipped, has decided to turn on somebody. Who has he turned on? Maybe Scooter Libby, maybe Dick Cheney himself. And the guy who had been the Cheney's Middle East expert appears to have been flipped by Fitzgerald. This guy's name is David Wormser. So here you've got the three people close, two people very close to, and the one person closest to the vice president, all apparently turning state's evidence. Apparently turning in somebody. Who could it be? Who could it be? And now you see, now we've got Pat Fitzgerald getting into this whole thing with the Niger documents and getting a report from Italy, taking us back to our Berlusconi alert from the last hour. All of this stuff, I'm telling you, all of this stuff, it's all coming together. It's not just about outing a CIA agent. It's about lying a country into the most serious and deadly thing that any nation can do, which is initiating the violence and murder of other human beings and calling it by the name of war, which slightly sanitizes it. That's what Dick Cheney did. That's what Scooter Libby was doing. That's what Wormser was doing. That's what Hadley was doing. That's what all of these guys, John Hanna, was doing. They were initiating violence leading to the death of human beings based on lies. For some reason, it could be political capital, could be...
Iraq sits on top of 10% of the world's oil reserves. Very significant reserve, second only to Saudi Arabia.
Who knows? 16 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
My bills are all due, and the babies need shoes, but I'm busted.
And welcome back, my friends.
Cotton is down to a quarter a pound, and I'm busted.
Yeah, it's sort of the direction we're all headed in as a country, isn't it? 21 minutes past the hour, 21 and a half minutes past the hour. Johnny Cash there singing about what life was like during tough times, or... You know, it's, and his dog died and the train hit his wife or his mother, his mama, and the, I don't know, the string of cliche. And in fact, you know, I started out in radio, going back in 1968, at the ripe old age of 17, as a country and western DJ, and I knew nothing about country western music, had never listened to it, but it was a job in radio, and came to just love Johnny Cash, I gotta tell you, just love Johnny Cash. Joe in Sand City, California on the line. Hey, Joe, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hello.
What's on your mind today?
I really appreciate all the information. We just recently got your station here. Before that, here in Sand City, we were stuck with, you know, Rush Limburger.
Yeah.
And anyway, what amazes me is you mentioned the Anwar oil thing, where they're really pushing for that. Are there any... congressmen that would want to access the interviews with the oil people down in the Katrina, Rita, you know, the Shreveport and Gulf Coast, who were ordered to cap off their oil wells even before these hurricanes, and that they have viable mucho oil that's just being that they've been told to stand down on it.
Yeah.
And then they put that 60 million barrels. Did anybody trace down where they went?
Well, this is ultimately, and I mean, you know,
they were put on the open market for these
sure.
These
I mean, this is not about the United States running out of oil. The reality is that we probably have hit world peak oil. That the United States hit peak oil back in the 70s. That doesn't mean that there's no more oil. That means that it's getting more expensive to produce the oil or to get the oil out of the ground.
Right, but wells that I just heard an interview just before, right after the hurricanes, where these people were kind of disgruntled that they had the oil and they were ordered to have them capped. We don't need to, these Arctic creatures are already in jeopardy because of the global warming.
Right.
We don't need to jeopardize them further just to send some...
No, we don't need the oil. And the rational thing to do, if you want to have a rational energy policy, Joe, would be for us to be taking the money that we're going to give in subsidies, essentially, to these corporations.
Right.
And instead putting that money into putting solar panels on houses, you know, all over the United States, giving people credits.
There's an island at the very end of Russia towards Alaska where Shell Oil has been taking phenomenal amounts of natural gas. Did you hear about that?
No.
I heard it on NPR about a month ago, where they're mad because they feel like they're being cheated. They're taking they're freezing this natural gas and condensing it down. You know how they do that?
Sure.
It's phenomenal amounts. So where are they're telling these little old ladies that are going to be freezing this winter, which is going to happen, that they have to pay more when they've got horrendous amount of fuel, and now these I forget the name of the island. It's on the very east.
On the tip of the Aleutians there?
Yeah, it's near there, but it's on the Russian side. They feel slighted because they're getting pennies on the dollar for all this vast amount of natural gas. Where is it that these companies can't be straightforward and just admit that they've got got these things and they're going to gouge the American people more like they've been doing.
Yeah, that's the bottom line, Joe, and you said it very well. And the bottom line is it's all about dollars. That's really what it's all about. There is, if you can pump oil out of the ground at the cost of $2 a barrel or $3 a barrel or $5 a barrel or $10 a barrel, and you can sell that oil for $20 a barrel or $30 or $50 or $70 a barrel, you can make money. It's that simple. And in fact, Saudi oil, you know, Saudi Arabia's oil fields are getting kind of old and creaky, and a lot of the Saudi oil is starting to cost, you know, $10, $12, $14 a barrel to suck it out of the ground, because you just got to drive the pump that much harder. And you got to drive the pump, by the way, with oil, you know, with gasoline or diesel fuel. You know, they actually have to pump this stuff out after a certain point. In the early years of a well, the oil or the natural gas just comes kind of bubbling out. But after you take a certain amount of oil out of there, you got to start sucking on that straw, you know, and you got to run the pump to suck on that straw. And then the lower the level goes, the harder you got to suck on the straw. And that becomes more and more expensive. It takes more and more energy to draw that up. And that energy, the amount of energy, is the cost. And so what's amazing is that some of the cheapest oil in the world was in Iraq. Because a lot of these wells had not been exploited. They hadn't been fully tapped. And so while the cost to pump oil was $12 to $14 a barrel in Saudi Arabia, here in the United States, in many cases, it was anywhere from $10 to $16 a barrel. The cost of oil in Iraq was $1.50 a barrel. Now, that's oil. If you're an oil company and you're talking about selling 1 billion barrels of oil, and you can buy it for $1.50 a barrel and sell it for $70, you'd much rather do that than buy it for $10 a barrel and sell it for $70, right? I mean, look at how much more money you can make. And that's what it's all about. The oil in Anwar is it's all about making money. There are billions of dollars to be made. If they can suck that oil out of the ground in the Alaskan National Wildlife Refuge, and, you know, it's going to take them 10 years to get it all together and to get that oil down here to the continental United States, they may not even bring it here. They may sell it to China or sell it to Japan, like they are some of the oil from Alaska right now. But the fact of the matter is that pulling that oil out of the ground and selling it is going to be profitable. And it's going to be profitable to the companies that are lining the pockets of the politicians in Washington, D.C., in both the Republican and the Democratic Party. Although the Republican Party seems to be pretty much 100% infested with this disease. 27 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
I was making my way through the wasteland. The road into town passes through. I was changing the radio station with my mind on you.
And welcome back, my friends. 34 and a half minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Truth and common sense in broadcasting for a change. The Tom Hartman radio program. We have Dr. Britt Minshall with us. Dr. Minshall, welcome to the program.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am great, but I'll get better. How about you?
10-4, right on the line.
Okay. Now, you are a former member of Interpol. From the old spy novels I used to read, Interpol, the International Police Agency?
Yeah, it is. But actually, I've started out as a police officer in Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. And after being a freedom rider during the civil rights movement, I've ended up getting thrown off the police department, obviously. I never had a chance to really, you know, fly. So I landed up actually operating a security agency in southern New Jersey, and we were the contact for Interpol if they needed to do investigative work.
Oh, that's
interesting. It's like a network.
Yeah, so it's a network that actually uses private agencies as well as governmental agencies?
Absolutely, and retired police officers, et cetera, right.
I was unaware of that. I thought it was a sort of like a UN agency, but it is by and large. Isn't Interpol by and large an intergovernmental agency, a cooperation?
Oh, absolutely, yeah. Scotland Yard and all those kind of people, yeah, they're all involved with it. But then when they get out in the hinterland, so to speak, if they need to get information on somebody, then they had a list of agencies they would use in a big book.
Yeah, now
once in a while we would do that type of work.
Right. We're talking with Dr. Britt Minshall, and you've written a book called Ring of Angels, which is about the situation in Haiti, if I have this correct.
Yes, you're right, Tom. What it basically is I've been going to Haiti for about 7 years now, and I gradually watched as our government literally ripped those people to shreds, especially to get to Aristide, to throw Aristide out, because he was the populist candidate.
Yeah, now let me just pause you right there, if I may,
sure.
Because I think a lot of Americans are still scratching their head about that. I mean, you had Jean-Bertrand Aristide, all of a sudden he's showing up in Central Africa going, you know, help, I've been kidnapped by the U.S., and, you know, ever since he's been gone, there's these armed gangs roaming the countryside. We've got, you know, chaos in Haiti, and there's been pretty much no coverage of it in the American press anymore.
None whatsoever. It's because it's our debacle. It was caused by the current White House.
Do you think that's it? I mean, I've been to Haiti a few times, and it's not the kind of place that, I mean, I was there with an international relief agency. It's not the kind of place that I would want to go to if I was looking for a place to vacation, or if I was a reporter and I wanted to say, hey, you know, send me someplace where I can do a story. I mean, there's a lot of places where you just say, you know, life is really rough here. You know, it's not, you know, and not to say that reporters are lazy or anything, but I just, you know, I get the sense that a lot of reporters would probably much rather be in Moscow or Paris or Frankfurt or something like that.
Well, yeah, and the poor people
in Port-au-Prince.
Well, just off the screen, really. That's what it's all about, and that's why I wrote the book.
Oh, that poverty doesn't get reported on in the United States, whether it's American poverty or Haitian poverty.
Right, especially if it's government policy that's creating it.
Okay, so why did we, first of all, did we depose Aristide?
Absolutely. The book begins in the year 2000 with an assassination attempt that I actually witnessed, a guy being sent from the NSA to do the job in Haiti, and it was declared by President Bush when he was first elected. Within 2 months, he interdicted Haiti and said that all of the aid to Haiti will now be moved to the International Republican Institute. And the sole job of using that $3 to $7 million was to discredit Aristide and to rip his governments to shreds.
So the money that we were sending down there, $3 to $7 million, is nothing. I mean, that's
no, it doesn't take much to destroy a country that's already destroyed.
Yeah. So the money we were sending down there that was supposed to be used for aid and food and things was now being used by the Bush administration to fund a propaganda campaign and a covert campaign against the democratically elected government, let us add.
Exactly. Because the rich people, which in Haiti are about 12%, you know, have there's evidently a huge amount of money in this country that those people have and have had here for a long time.
In Haiti. In other words, there's a lot of millionaires and there's a whole lot of people just flat out desperately poor.
Right, exactly.
And not much in between.
You've got the sweatshop operators like Andy Apeg, who is making stuff for Walmart and stuff like that. And when Aristide came in, the first thing he did was move the minimum daily wage from 86 cents a day to $1.56. And needless to say, calls were made, and immediately Aristide was done.
So
I saw this all take place. And when we go to Haiti, we stay in a brothel right in the heart of Port-au-Prince. Now, remember, I'm a pastor, okay? So we do this thing right.
You have to qualify this.
Yeah, I have to qualify that.
All
but
right.
I want my people, when I take them to Haiti, to see the real Haiti,
mm-hmm.
not something that's hidden away.
Yeah.
And so we go out all day long into the jungles and down into Cité Soleil, to the slums. We meet the people. We meet the children. But at night, we come back together in this hotel in the heart of Port-au-Prince, where the book was written. And that's where the Ring of Angels are. They are the teenage prostitutes that are in the building. And we keep telling the story over this five-day period of the assassins, what they did lined up, of us, of some ministers who evidently fell to the girls, some people, families that fall apart, and all the tragedy. And behind the scenes in the book, you can see played out the entire government involvement right up through the end of 2001.
We're talking to Dr. Britt Minshall. He's the author of the book, The Ring of Angels, about the situation in Haiti, or Haiti. And the United States intervened in Haiti so that we could maintain basically sweatshop labor and so that Aristide could not engage in what the Bush administration would probably characterize as socialist policies. This is the same, it sounds to me like the same movie that is being played right now with Pat Robertson calling for the assassination of Hugo Chavez.
Well, interestingly enough, Tom, in the book, I predict that. And remember, the book was written in 2001. It actually just came out a few months ago. But, you know, you write a book 3 years ahead of time.
Sure.
And the NSA agent that tried to kill Aristide was right here from Maryland. And he sits back smoking a Cuban cigar and telling a drug dealer that financed the whole assassination attempt that we'll get Aristide and we're going to get that Hugo Chavez in Venezuela too. And I saw that coming, and I even portray some secret meetings. By the way, the book is listed as fiction because some of the names are changed. But let me tell you something. This book is as true as it can possibly be.
Mm-hmm.
So everything that's played out in this book is actually true. And I saw these events taking place, and I documented them in a fictional setting in the book, trying to get to people that are, quote, out there, end quote.
To give you some of your sources some safety, anonymity, is that?
Well, that too. There's a fellow in the book that is supposed to be the local assassin. And actually, I can say his name now. It's Guy Philippe. And he is an international criminal, and we deal with him quite heavily. He's one of our champs, and he's an extremely dangerous human being.
So what's the solution, Dr. Britt Minshall? What should America be doing or not doing with regard to Haiti?
People have to scream. I've used kind of Haiti as a parable, like Jesus would, a small story, because this kind of behavior, Tom, is what we're doing all over the world, really. But if we're doing it like 180 miles off of our shoreline to people that have no ability whatsoever to harm us. You know, when I've been on some stations, of course you get onto the small right-wing stations down somewhere in the south, you know, immediately they told me about the terrorists coming from Haiti.
Right.
Haiti has no ability to deliver terrorists here.
Yeah, they hardly have the ability to deliver refugees here.
Exactly, and the same thing with drugs. Evidently, the story was passed around by our State Department. And by the way, I just want to tell you to let you know, I do have documented evidence. I landed up in the State Department quite by accident, delivering a petition, and I met Colin Powell and the head of the Caribbean Division, and I was put into a room waiting to have a final interview and present this petition. Was to restore water aid to Haiti,
mm-hmm.
and my denomination, the United Church of Christ, we had signed like 3,000 signatures. And while we were there, we looked down the hall, and we saw a group of Haitian businessmen, some of whom we recognized. This is when Aristide is still in office, 7 months before the coup that took him out. They're in the State Department walking back and forth.
These are the rich, powerful guys in Haiti.
Very powerful, right.
Yeah.
And there was a table there with a sign, take one. So, you know, numbnuts hear me, I take one. And I take five or six of these pieces of paper, and we did our business, and we left. And I said to the guy that was with me, there's going to be a revolution or a coup in Haiti in 3 to 6 months, guaranteed. And, of course, it happened. Okay, a year later, I landed up pulling those papers out of my filing cabinet, and here it's the plan in the State Department of who's going to take over all of the offices the second we get Aristide out. And it says confidential, top secret all over it, and I have it.
Amazing. So, Dr. Britt Minshall, you're suggesting in your book, Ring of Angels, and in this interview, I guess, we have just a few seconds left, that we need to wake up Americans to the horrors of a foreign policy driven in the interests of sweatshop operators and wealthy elites in these other countries. Is that the bottom line here?
That's right, Tom, and it's a good, exciting book, too.
Okay.
It even has some sex in it.
Okay. Is there a website for where people can find out more information?
Yes, sir. Ringofangels.com.
Ringofangels.com.
And there's excerpts in there, and I'm sure they'll enjoy the website as well.
Pretty straightforward. Dr. Britt Minshall, a former member of Interpol, a pastor with the United Church of Christ, you said?
Yes, sir, in Baltimore.
In Baltimore, and author of Ring of Angels. Is there one particular, by the way, just very quickly, is there a particular piece of legislation or anything that people could contact their elected representatives about relative to this, or should they just say back off of Haiti?
Well, contact Barbara Waters. If they contact Congressman Barbara Waters, she's the leader of this movement to get the priests out of jail.
She knows what's going on.
1,200 people out of jail.
Great. Okay, thanks a lot. Dr. Minshall, thanks so much for being with us.
Okay,
I appreciate
it. Okay, take your time.
It's a Tom Hartman radio program, 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
There's a brand new dance just hit this town.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here, the program where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. I'm here with your daily minimum, daily adult requirement of sanity. 1-866-440-8466. Our telephone number, 1-866-440-THOM. It's 9.5 minutes before the top of the hour. And Alice in Eureka, California on the line. Hey, Alice, welcome to the program.
What kind of people do such a thing? I'm talking about planning wars for their own reasons. Some of us think it's greed, or perhaps for political advantage. These are people that don't mind getting a lot of people killed for their own purposes. What would you call them, Tom?
Politicians. What would you call them, Alice?
Well, they're not very good.
Yeah. It's the tragedy of our time. It's the mental
terrible
illness of our society, Alice. There's,
I know.
The Native Americans, it's interesting. I interviewed Dr. Jack Forbes, who is a Native American. He's a professor of Native American studies at the University of California at Davis. And I interviewed him for my book, The Last Hours of Ancient Sunlight. And he said, you know, and he wrote a brilliant book called Columbus and Other Cannibals. And I said, he said, you know, the Native Americans had, or his tribe, I guess, or his group, he said, we had have a word for the psychology, for the mental illness that Europeans brought to this continent. He said it was called wetiko. And I said, what does wetiko mean? And he said, it means one who eats the life of another. It's sort of like cannibal. You don't literally eat the other person, but you eat everything. Yeah, you consume their ability to live and leave them in poverty and leave them in desperation. And he said, we see you people of European ancestry as sort of cannibals, you know, as wetiko, as having this mental illness. And that's, Alice, I guess in answer to your question, I'd have to say I think that that's the mental illness of our culture, and that's what we need to be waking up from.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for calling. It's always wonderful to hear from you, Alice. It's one of my favorite callers. Larry in Seattle, Washington. Hey, Larry, what's up?
Yes, Tom. Some people might call those individuals spiritual vampires.
Yeah, there's that, too. Or hungry ghosts is another phrase that I know that, what's the, Dancing with the Ghost. Rupert Ross wrote a book called Dancing with the Ghost about his experience living with Native American communities up in Canada. And he talked about this, the whole idea of their viewing our culture as a culture that produces people who are essentially hungry ghosts, spiritually empty. Yeah.
Well, I was going to ask your guest if he had run into any evidence on Elliot Abrams being part of the instigation of the coup attempts against both Aristide and Chavez. But since she's gone, I want to shift over to this speech that Bush gave to the Wives Club back on Monday. He used a common phrase that he seems to use quite often about some arguing that extremism is strengthened by the actions of our coalition in Iraq. But I would have reminded them that we were not in Iraq on September 11, 2001. Excuse me, but weren't we bombing Iraq continuously in the no-fly zones for 10 years?
Doesn't yeah, we were, but they weren't
in Iraq for all of that time period. Doesn't that make that a direct lie?
Well, yes, but his point was that what he was trying to cause Americans to believe was that terrorists came from Iraq and struck on 9/11, struck the World Trade Center and the Pentagon for no particular reason, just because they're evil people or because they belong to a religion which isn't the right religion or believes bizarre things. And so that's why he had to phrase that the way he phrased it. I mean, you're right that we were bombing Iraq on 9/11, probably on that very day of 9/11, since we were pretty much bombing them every single day in one way or another. But that had nothing to do with 9/11. There is no relationship between the two. And for that matter, oddly enough, Bush himself actually once admitted that there was no connection between 9/11.
Oh, yeah,
and,
I've heard that quote over and over again.
Well, here it is, right here.
We've had no evidence that Saddam Hussein was involved with the September the 11th.
Yeah. No evidence.
And then it goes back to the same statement.
Yeah, I know. It's absolutely incredible. But Larry, thanks a lot for the call and for making that point. It's good to hear from you. And, you know, I appreciate it. Dan in Seattle. Hey, Dan, what's up?
Hey, Tom, are you going to come up to Seattle tonight and listen to Joe Wilson?
No, but I would love to. I haven't talked to Joe Wilson. Well, he was on this program maybe a month or so ago. So if you see him, tell him I said hi. He's a good man, one of my heroes.
One thing real quick about Anwar.
Yeah.
Is I say let's drill in Anwar and take the environmental damage that's done there and fix something somewhere else to where it's a neutral thing as far as the environment's concerned, and we've restored some other area that doesn't have oil.
Here's the problem with that logic, Dan. The problem with that logic assumes that the environment is like a car, which you can take apart and put back together. And in fact, it's not. The environment is more like a cow. If you try and take a cow apart and put it back together, it's not alive anymore. But if I put a car back together, I can still drive it. You know, the environment is a living thing. It's not a machine.
Yeah, it is really nice up there.
Yeah, it really is. And there's a lot of oil, and there's a relatively small amount of oil, actually, but a lot of money to be made off the oil up there, and that's really what it's all about. Dan, I appreciate the call and your comments, and, you know, I think, you know, you're spot on that, you know, we should be thinking about the environment, but frankly, the psychology, the mentality, the idea that if we break this here, we can fix that over there, you know, while well-intentioned, and, you know, it's a kind, considerate, a healthy beginning point. We really have to realize that this world that we live in is a living organism. It's not a machine. That was Aristotle's big error, for those of you who are into that kind of stuff. The whole idea, his atomic idea, that the universe was just a giant machine. If we could just figure out where all the levers are, we could, you know, move everything to our will. Sorry, it's all a living thing, and we're part of it all. And I'm starting to sound like some kind of New Age thing, but I'm not. I mean, this is the physical reality that we have to deal with. Anyhow, thanks a lot for being with us today. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place. Remember, activism begins with you. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.